Near my residence stands a large billboard which advertises a specific brand of beer, which I do not see the need to mention by name as I am neither partial nor impartial to any specific brand of beer. And that's a total load of crap. But anyway, the billboard features a bottle of this beer in front of a snow-capped mountain. And I get it, this imagery. It's a hot summer day here, and I, like anyone, might thirst for an ice-cold snow-capped bottle of beer. But this only begs me to ask, and not out of irony or disdain for advertising, so much as genuine curiosity, if you are listening from a snow-capped mountain, how exactly is your beer being marketed to you? Because I can tell you now, from some experience, that an image of piss-warm, desert sun-drenched beer would be horribly misrepresenting. So if this is you, and you are listening from some iced-cold snow-capped mountain, please do get in touch. And for you and all others, good evening. It's Sunday, the 9th of July, 2006, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. His Mother by Mavis Gallant. His mother had come of age in a war, and then seemed to live a long greyness, like a spun-out November. "Are you all right?" she used to ask him at breakfast. What she really meant was, "Ask me how I am." But she was his mother, and so he would not. He leaned two fists against his temples and read a book about photography, waiting for her to cut braid and put it on a plate for him. He seldom looked up, never truly saw her, a stately, careless widow with unbrushed red hair, wearing an old fur coat over her nightgown. Her last dressing-gown had been worn to ribbons, and she said she had no money for another. It seemed that nothing could stop her from telling him how she felt, or from pestering him with questions. She muttered, and smoked, and drank such a lot of strong coffee that it made her bilious, and then she would moan, "God, God, my liver, my poor head!" In those days, in Budapest, you had to know the black market to find the sort of coffee she drank, and, of course, she would not have had any but the finest smuggled Virginia cigarettes. "Quality," she said to him, or to his profile, rather. "Remember, after I have died, that quality was important to me. I held out for the best." She had known what it was to take excellence for granted. That was the difference between them. Out of her youth she could not recall a door slammed or a voice raised except in laughter. People had floated like golden dust, whole streets of people buoyed up by optimism, a feeling for life. He sat reading, waiting for her to serve him. He was a stone out of a stony generation. Talking to him was like lifting a stone out of water. He never resisted, but if you let go for even a second, he sank and came to rest on a dark sea floor. More than one of her soft-tempered lovers had tried to make a friend of him, but they had always given up, as they did with everything. How could she give up? She loved him. She felt ashamed because it had not been in her to control armies, history, his stony, watery world. From the moment he appeared in the kitchen doorway, passive, vacant, starting to live again only because this was morning, she began all over. "Don't you feel well? Are you all right? Why can't you smile?" Though the loudest sentence was in silent. "Ask me how I am." After he left Budapest, got his first passport, flew to Glasgow with a soccer team, never came back. She became another sort of person, an émigré's mother. she shed the last of her unimportant lovers, and with the money her son was soon able to send, she bought a white blouse, combs that would pin her hair away from her face, and a blue kimono. She remembered long, tender conversations they had had together, and she got up early in the morning to see if a letter had come from him, and then to write one of her own describing everything she thought and did. His letters to his mother said, "Tell me about your headaches. Are you still drinking too strong coffee? Tell me the weather, the names of streets, and if you still bake poppy-seed cakes." She had never been any sort of a cook, but it seemed to her that, yes, she had baked for him, perhaps in their early years together, which she looked back upon as golden and lighter than thistledown. On Saturday afternoons she put on a hat and soft grey gloves and went to the Vorismarty Café. It had once had a French name, Gerbaud, and the circle of émigré's mothers who met to exchange news and pictures of grandchildren still called it that. Gerbaud was a sign of caste and the mark of a generation Jew. Like herself, the women wore hats and sometimes scarves of fur, and each carried a stuffed handbag she would not have left behind on a tabletop for even a second. Their son's letters looked overstamped, like those he sent her now. She had not been so certain of her rank before, or felt so quietly sure, so well thought of. A social order prevailed, as it does everywhere. The aristocrats were those whose children had never left Europe. The poorest of the poor were not even likely to see their sons again, for they had gone to Chile and South Africa. Switzerland was superior to California. A city earned more points than a town. There was no mistaking her precedence here. She was a grand duchess. If Glasgow was unfamiliar, the very sound of it somehow rang with merit. She always had a new letter to show, which was another symbol of one's station, and they were warm messages, concerned about her health, praising her remembered skill with pies and cakes. Some mothers were condemned to a lowly status only because their children forgot to write. Others had to be satisfied with notes from foreign daughters-in-law, which were often sent from table to table before an adequate reading could be obtained. Here again she was in demand, for she read three foreign languages, which suggested a background of governess and careful schools. She might have left it at that, but her trump credentials were in plain sight. These were the gifts he bestowed, the scarves and pastel sweaters, the earrings and gloves. What she could not do was bring the émigré ritual to its final celebration. It required a passport, a plane ticket, and a visit to the absent son. She would never deliver into his hands the three immutable presents, which were family jewellery, family photographs, and a cake. Any mother travelling to within even a few miles of another woman's son was commissioned to take all three. The cake was a bother to carry, for the traveller usually had one of her own, but who could say no? They all knew the cake's true value. Look at the way her own son claimed his share of nourishment from a mother whose cooking had always been a joke. No one had ever been close to Scotland, and if she had not applied for her own passport or looked up flight schedules, it was for a good reason. Her son had never suggested she come. And yet, denied even the bliss of sewing a garnet clip into her brassiere to be smuggled into an unknown daughter-in-law, she knew she was blessed. Other women were dismissed, forgotten. More than one had confided, "My son might as well be dead." She did not think of him as dead, how could she, but as a coin that had dropped unheard and had rolled crazily lay still. She knew the name of his car, of his street. She had seen pictures of them. But what did she know? After he disappeared, as soon as she had made certain he was safe and alive, she rented his room to a student who stayed with her for 3 years in conditions of some discomfort, for she had refused at first to remove anything belonging to her son. His books were sacred, his records were not to be played. The records had been quite valuable at one time. They were early American rock slipped in by way of Vienna and sold at a murderous rate of exchange. These collected dust now, for although she pinned her hair up with combs and wore a spotless blouse, she was still no better a housekeeper. Her tenant studied forestry. He was a bumpkin and somewhat afraid of her. She could never have mistaken him for a son. He crept in and out and brought her flowers. One day she played a record for him, to which he listened with deference rather than interest, and she remembered herself at 18, hearing with the same anxious boredom a warped scene from De Valkyrie, both singers now long dead. Having a student in the flat did not make her feel she was in touch with her son, or even with his generation. His room changed meanwhile. Even its smell was no longer the same. She began to wonder what his voice had been like. She could see him. She dreamed of him often, but her dreams and memories were like films with the soundtrack removed. The bumpkin departed, and she took in his place a future art historian. The regime produced these in awesome numbers now, who gave way in turn to the neurasthenic widow of a poet. The poet's widow was taken over in time by her children and replaced by a couple of young librarians. And then came two persons not quite chosen by herself. She could have refused them, but thought it wiser not to. They were an old man and his pregnant granddaughter. They seemed to be brokenly poor. The granddaughter, almost to the end of her term, worked long hours in a plasma laboratory. And yet they appeared endowed with dark, important connections. No sooner were they installed than she was granted a telephone, which her tenants never used without asking, and only for laconic messages. The grandfather to state that his granddaughter was not yet at home, or the girl to take down the day and hour of a meeting somewhere. After the granddaughter had her baby, they became four in a flat that had barely been comfortable for two. She cleared out the last of her son's records and his remaining books. The rest had long ago been sold or stolen, and tried to establish a set of rules. For one, she made it a point to remain in the kitchen when her tenants took their meals. This was her home. It was not strictly a shared and still less a communal Russian apartment. But she could only go so far. It was at Gerbeau's that she ranked as a Grand Duchess. These people reckoned differently, and on their terms she was, if not at the foot of the ladder, then dangerously to one side of it. She had an emigre son. She received gifts and money from abroad, and she led, in terms of the common good, a parasitic existence. They were careful, even polite, but they were installed. She was inhabited by them, as by an illness one must learn to endure. It was around this time when her careless, undusted, but somehow pure rooms became a slum festooned with washing, reeking of boiling milk, where she was seldom alone or quiet, that she began to drift away from an idea she had held about her age and time. Where exactly was the youth she recalled as happy? What had been its shape, its colour? All that golden dust had not belonged to her. It had been a part of her mother. It was her mother who had floated like thistledown, smiled, lived with three servants on call, stood with a false charming gaucherie, an arm behind her, an elbow grasped. That simulated awkwardness took suppleness and training. It required something her generation had not been granted, which was time. Her mother had let her coat fall on the floor because coats were replaceable then, not only because there had been someone to pick it up. She had carried a little curling iron in her handbag. When she quarrelled with her husband, she went to the station and climbed into a train marked Budapest-Vienna-Rome, and her husband had thought it no more than amusing to have to fetch her back. Slowly, as 18 came to mean an age much younger than her son's, as he grew older in Scotland, married, had a child, began slipping English words into her letters, went on about fictitious apple or poppy seed cakes, she parted without pain from a soft, troubled memory, from an old grey film about porters wheeling steamer trunks, white fur wraps, bunches of violets, champagne. It was gone. It had never been. She and her son were both mistaken, and yet they had never been closer. Now that she had the telephone, he called her on Easter Sunday, and on Christmas Eve, and on her birthday. His wife had spoken to her in English. "It's snowing here. Is it snowing in Budapest?" "It quite often snows." "I hope we can meet soon." "That would be pleasant." His wife's parents sent her Christmas greetings with stern biblical messages, as if they judged her, by way of her son, to be frivolous without a proper God. At least they knew now that she spoke correct English. On the other hand, perhaps they were simple souls, unable to imagine that anything but English could ever be. They were not out of touch, nor did he neglect her. No one could say that he had. He had never missed a monthly transfer of money. He was faithful about sending his overstamped letters and the coloured snapshots of his wife, his child, their Christmas tree, and his wife's parents side by side upon a modern-looking sofa. One unposed picture had him up a ladder pasting sheets of plastic tiles on a kitchen wall. She could not understand the meaning of this photograph, in which he wore jeans and a sweater that might have been knitted by an untalented child. His hair had grown long. It straggled in brown mouse tails over the collar of the lamentable pullover. He stood in profile so that she could see just half of a new and abundant moustache. Also, and this might have been owing to the way he stood because he had to swear to hold his balance, he looked as if he might have become, well, a trifle stout. This was the picture she never showed anyone at Vorosmarty Place, though she examined it often by several kinds of light. What did it mean? What was its secret expression? She looked for the invisible ink that might describe her son as a husband and father. He was 28. He had a moustache. He worked in his own home as a common labourer. She said to herself, "I never let him lift a finger. I waited on him from the time he opened his eyes." In response to the ladder picture, she employed a photographer, a former school friend of her son's, to take a fiercely lighted portrait of her sitting on her divan bed with a volume of impressionist reproductions open on her lap. She wore a string of garnets and turned her head proudly without gaping or grinning. From the background wall she had removed a picture of clouds taken by her son, then a talented amateur, and hung in its state a framed parchment that proved her mother's family had been ennobled. Actually, a whole town had been ennobled at a stroke, but the parchment was legal and real. Normally it would not have been in her to display the skin of the dog, as these things were named, but perhaps her son's wife, looking at the new proud picture of his mother, might inquire, "What is that there on the wall?" She wrote him almost every morning. She had for years now. At night her thoughts were morbid, unchecked, and she might have been likely to tell about her dreams, or to describe the insignificant sadness of a lifetime, or to recall the mornings when he had eaten breakfast in silence, when talking to him had been like lifting a stone. Her letters held none of these things. She wrote wearing her blue, clean, now elderly kimono, sitting at the end of her kitchen table, while her tenants ate and quarrelled endlessly. She had a long, back-slanting hand she had once been told was the hand of a liar. Upside down, the letter looked like a shower of rain. It was strange. Mysterious, she wrote, to be here in the kitchen with the winter sun on the sparkling window. It was grimy, in fact, but she was seeing quite another window as she wrote. And the tenant granddaughter, whose name was Ilona, home late on a weekday. Ilona and the baby and the grandfather were all three going to a funeral this morning. It seemed a joyous sort of excursion, because someone was fetching them by car, and that in itself was an indication of their somber connections. It explained, in shorthand, why she had not squarely refused to take them in. She wrote that the neighbours' radios could be heard faintly like the sounds of life breaking into a fever, and about Ilona preparing a boiled egg for the baby, drawing a face on the shell to make it interesting, and the baby opening his mouth, patting the table in a broken rhythm, patting crumbs with a spread-out hand. Here in the old kitchen she shared a wintry, secret morning life with strangers. Grandfather wore a hearing aid, but he had taken it apart, and it lay now on the table like parts of a doll's skull. Wearing it at breakfast kept him from enjoying his food. Spectacles bothered him too. He made a noise eating, because he could not hear himself, nor did he see the mess around his cup and plate. "Worse than an infant!" his granddaughter cried. She had a cross-looking Tartar face. She tore squares of newspaper, one to go on the floor, another for underneath his plate. He scattered sugar and pipe-ash and crusts and the little pieces of his hearing aid. At the same time he was trying to attend to a crossword puzzle, which he looked at with a magnifying glass. But he still would not put his spectacles on, because they interfered with his food. Being deaf, he travelled alone in his memories, and sometimes came out with just anything. His mind plodded back and forth. Looking up from the puzzle, he said loudly, "My granddaughter has a diploma. Indeed she has. She worked in a hospital." "Yes, she did. Some people think too much of themselves when they have a diploma. They begin to speak pure Hungarian. They try to speak like educated people." "Not Ilona. You will never hear one word of good Hungarian from her." His granddaughter had just untied a towel she used as a bib for the child. She grimaced, and buried her Tartar's grimace in the towel. Only her brown hair was seen, and her shaking shoulders. She might have been laughing. Her grandfather wore a benign and rather foolish smile until she looked up and screamed, "I hate you!" She reminded him of all that she had done to make him happy. She described the last place they'd lived in, the water gurgling in the pipes, the smell of bedbugs. She had found this splendid apartment. She was paying their rent. His little pension scarcely covered the coffee he drank. "You thought your son was too good for my mother," she said. "You made her miserable, too." The old man could not hear any of this. His shaking freckled hands had been assembling the hearing aid. He adjusted it in time to hear Ilona say, "It is hard to be given lessons in correct speech by someone who eats like a pig." He sighed and said only, "Children," as one might sound resigned to any natural enemy. The emigre's mother, their landlady, had stopped writing. She looked up, not at them, but of course they believed they could be seen. They began to talk about their past family history, as they did when they became tense and excited, and it all went into the letter. Ilona had lost her father, her mother, and her little sister in a road accident when, with grandfather, they had been on their way to a funeral in the suburbs on a bus. Funerals seemed to be the only outing they ever enjoyed. The old man listened to Ilona telling it again, but presently he got up and left them, as if the death of his son allowed him no relief, even so many years later. When he came back, he had his hat and coat on. For some reason he had misunderstood, and thought they had to leave at once for the new excursion. He took his landlady's hand and pumped it up and down, saying, "From the bottom of my heart," though all he was leading up to was, "Goodbye." He did not let her hand go until he inadvertently brought it down hard on a thick cup. "He has always embarrassed us in public," said Ilona, clearing away. "What could we do? He was my father's father." "That other time," said the old man, calmed now, sitting down in his overcoat, "the day of the fatal funeral, there had been time to spare, out in a suburb, where they had to change from one bus to another. They had walked once around a frozen duck pond. He had been amazed, the old man remembered, at how many people were free on a working weekday. His son carried one of the children. Little Ilona walked." "Of course I walked. I was 12," she screamed from the sink. He had been afraid that Ilona would never learn to speak because her mother said everything for her. When Ilona pointed with her woolly fist, her mother crooned, "Skaters," or else she announced, "You are cold," and put a scarf up over Ilona's apple cheeks. "That was my sister," Ilona said. "I was 12. "Now, a governess might have made that child speak, say words correctly," said the old man. "Mothers are helpless. They can only say yes, yes, and try to repeat what the child seems to be thinking." "He has always embarrassed us," Ilona said. "My mother hated going anywhere in his company." Once around the duck pond, and then an old bus rattled up and they got in. The driver was late, and to make up for time, he drove fast. At the bottom of a hill, on a wide sheet of black ice, the bus turned like a bulky horse, rocked, steadied, and the driver threw himself over the wheel as if to protect it. An army lorry came down the hill, the first of two. Ilona's mother pulled the baby against her and pulled Ilona's head up on her lap. 8 killed, including the two drivers," Ilona said. Here was their folklore, their richness. How many persons have lost their families on a bus and survived to describe the Holocaust? No wonder she and grandfather were still together. If she had not married her child's father, it was because he had not wanted grandfather to live with them. "You, yes," he had said to Ilona, "relatives, no." Grandfather nodded, for he was used to hearing this. Her cold sacrifice always came on top of his disapproval. Well, that was not quite the truth of it, the emigre's mother went on writing. The man who had interceded for them, whom she had felt it was wiser not to refuse, who might be the child's father, had been married for quite a long time. The old man looked blank and strained. His eyes had become small. He looked Chinese. "Where we lived then was a good place to live with children," he said, perhaps speaking of a quarter fading like the edge of a watercolour into a grey apartment blocks. Something had frightened him. He took out a clean pocket handkerchief and held it to his lips. "Another army lorry took us to the hospital," said Ilona. "Do you know what you were saying?" He remembered an ambulance. He and his grandchild had been wrapped in blankets, had lain on two stretchers, side by side, fingers locked together. That was what he remembered. "You say it. My mother," she told him.
"I don't think I said that."
Now they were having their usual disagreement, she wrote her son. "Lorry or ambulance?" "I heard," said Ilona. "I was conscious."
"I had no reason. If I said my mother, I was thinking my children." The rain would cover pages more. Her letter had veered off and resembled her thoughts at night. She began to tell him she had trouble sleeping. She had been given a wonderful new drug, but unfortunately it was habit-forming, and the doctor would not renew it. The drug gave her a deep sleep, from which she emerged fresh and enlivened, as if she had been swimming. During the sleep she was allowed exact and coloured dreams in which she was a young girl again, and men long dead came to visit. They sat amiably discussing their deaths. Her first fiancé, killed in 1943, opened his shirt to show the chest wound. He apologized for having died without warning. He did not know that less than a year later she had married another man. The dead had no knowledge of love beyond the span of their own lives. The next night she found herself with her son's father. They were standing together buying tickets for a play when she realized he was dead. He stood in his post-war shabbiness, discreet, hidden mind, camouflaged face, and he had ceased to be with the living. Her grief was so cruel that, lest she perish in sleep from the shock of it, someone unseen but conciliating suggested that she trade any person she knew in order to keep him with her. He would never have the misery of knowing that he was dead. What would her son say to all this? "My mother is now at an age when women dream of dead men," he might tell himself, "when they begin to choose quite carelessly between the dead and the living. Women are crafty, even in their sleep. They know they will survive. Why weep? Why discuss? Why let things annoy you?" For a long time she believed he had left because he could not look at her life. Perhaps his going had been as artless, as simple, as he still insisted. He had got his first passport, flew out with a football team, never come back. He was between the dead and the living, a voice on the telephone, an affectionate letter full of English words, a coin rolled and lying somewhere in secret. And she? She was the revered and respected mother of a generous, an attentive, a camouflaged stranger. "Tell me the weather," he still wrote. "Tell me the names of streets." She began a new page. "For a smarty place, if you remember, is at the beginning of Varsi Street, the oldest street in the old city. In the middle of a place stands a little park. Our great poet, for whom the place is named, sits carved in marble. Sculptured figures look gratefully up to him. They are grateful because he is the author of the national anthem. There are plain trees full of sparrows, and there are bus stops, and even a little metro, the oldest in Europe, perhaps old-fashioned but practical. It goes to the zoo, the Fine Arts Museum, the Museum of Decorative Art, the Academy of Music, and the Opera. The old redoubt is there too, at least one wall of it backed up to a new building where you go to book seats for concerts. The real face of the redoubt has been in ruins since the end of the war. It used to be Moorish, romantic. The old part, which gave on the Danube, had in her day, no, in her mother's day, been a large concert hall, the reconstruction of which created grave problems because of modern acoustics. "At Gerbeau's the pastries are still the best in Europe," she wrote, "and so are the prices. There are five or six little rooms, little marble tables, comfortable chairs. Between the stiff lace curtains and the window panes are quite valuable pieces of china. In summer one can sit on the pavement. There is enough space between the plain trees, and the ladies with their elegant hats are not in too much danger from the sparrows. If you come there, you will see younger people too, and foreigners, and women who wait for foreigners, but most of the customers, yes, most, belong to the magic circle of mothers whose children have gone away. The café opens at 10 and closes at 9. It is always crowded. You can often find me there," she went on, "and without fail every Saturday," as if she might look up and see him draw near, transformed, amnesiac, not knowing her. "I hope that I am not in your dreams," she said, "because dreams are populated by the silent and the dead, and I still speak. I am alive. I wear a hat with a brim and soft grey gloves. I read their letters in three foreign languages. Thanks to you, I can order an endless succession of little cakes. I can even sip cognac. Will you still know me? I was your mother.